website that has literally tens of thousands of lectures of Torah, spirituality, pretty interesting stuff. So I don't really have a good opener. I usually pride myself on my openers. When you Google around and you look for an opener on a class on sex, there's just nothing really a rabbi can share. That's like, it's not even like PG-13, R. They're all just awful, terrible, bad openers. But I will say one thing that I used as an opener to this chapter in my book that I wrote on sexuality. And so my son, who's Bli Ayin Hara now, 22, when he was 9, he was crazy into cars. He was just like a car fanatic. He loved cars. He collected cars. And whenever like a car commercial would come on, he'd like perk up, you know, if we'd watch TV. And there was this one really cool, sleek car. Hello, Perry. Welcome. That was he was really interested in watching. And there was this very attractive, scantily clad young woman who was kind of slivering about the car. You know, if you've ever seen some of these car commercials. And I was watching my son watch this in his sort of 9-year-old pubescent stage. And he kept like doing this. Not looking at the girl, but trying to get around the girl to see the car. And he was getting increasingly annoyed. He was getting like increasingly annoyed because he was like, you know, like, ugh, she kept like covering up all the cool features of the car until he like blurted out. And he's like, Daddy, like, can you get her out of there? Like, what is she doing there anyway? Aren't they trying to just sell a car? It was very deep. And I was like, they are trying to sell a car. So why is she in there? Why is she in the commercial for the car? Why don't they just put the car? So I had to explain to my 9-year-old that I guess the advertisers think that we, the viewers, will think that if I can get a car like that, maybe I can get a girl like that. I guess that's the subliminal message that's being... Because what's she doing in there? So the reason I'm opening with that is because it's the only like appropriate thing I could think of to open up our conversation about sexuality. But it really shows, unfortunately, the way sex is being used so much. We live in a very over-sexualized society that is just so in our face. And we use it to sell cars, and we use it to sell anything. I remember when Victoria's Secret came here on Broadway, there was a group of moms, my wife among them, who wrote a letter to the head of Victoria's Secret asking if they could be a little less explicit with these magnificently large posters of some very, very beautiful women in, you know, underwear, basically. And it's something we kind of take for granted. On the other hand, I think we also, in some kind of strange way, pay maybe lip service or homage to another very different kind of view of sexuality in our society. And these two very opposite views, which I'm going to get into the other view in a minute, which is very religious, I don't mean Jewish religious, but really Christian religious, Catholicism specifically, it was illustrated in an amazing book that I would really encourage you to get. Is it not in print? I think it was called Hedge of Roses, by Dr. Norman Lamb. He was the president of Yeshiva University, and also we named our fellowship program for Rabbi Lamb. I knew him. He was a teacher of mine. He passed away during COVID. He was a lovely, just a gentleman and a huge scholar. And he wrote a book called Hedge of Roses. Has anyone heard that term?
Hedge.
A hedge, H-E-D-G-E. Mm-hmm. You know, like, that term is taken from the Talmud, and it's supposed to describe the separation, and maybe we'll talk a little about this later, that a man and a woman during the period of menstruation for a woman, that they separate during that period of time when, let's say, a religious Jewish couple is married, they don't have any physical contact during the period of nida. And there's kind of like this separation, but the Talmud calls it a hedge of roses. Like they're separated, but they're separated by roses. Very beautiful image. He wrote this book. And in the book, he says that, you know, before he sets out what he considers to be the uniquely Jewish view on sexuality, he describes the way he thinks most modern Westerns think. Okay, and he wrote this in the 50s for a group of young couples that he was giving a class to in Springfield, Massachusetts, where he was a rabbi before he came to New York. And he says that we're confronted by these two contradictory concepts of sex, which we think are new, but they're really just fundamentally a restatement of an ancient attitude towards sex. And he says, paradoxically, we suffer from the resulting inner contradictions, because he thinks that we embrace both, even though they contradict. What are they? So the one is a very open attitude towards sex, in which there are... That's my fault. There are basically no secrets left. He says, and I quote, "We strip sex of its shroud of mystery, which we consider mere romantic nonsense. We look upon it like just a regular biological urge. I have to eat. I have to go to the bathroom. We have sex." And we condemn, he says, traditional religious and moral standards as hypocritical or guilt-breeding and neurosis-inducing prudery at best. Now, you could see from the... this is the way Rabbi Lamboys wrote. "Playboy is the Bible of our sexual revolution." This is, I guess, when Playboy was very big. "Its various imitators and mutants, a new apocrypha and pseudo-apocrypha, the novelists of depravity, the enthusiastic college instructors, the unqualified teams of sex therapists, the smut salesmen who appear in court as the champions of free speech and free press, all the preachers of permissiveness, these are its priests and prophets, the casual and cool approach, its official theology, the inhibitions of traditional morality, its devil." And that, says Rabbi Lam, is nothing new. That's the way, by the way, he used to speak in a casual conversation. The psychological veneer in the existentialist vernacular, he said, may be novel, but the underlying theories are no different than the paganism that used to express itself in the days of the prostitution of Canaan to the debauchery, he says, of Rome. And he says that this primal urge, or the sanctity of pleasure, was very much known to the ancient world, and this quote-unquote new morality in the guise is just the old hedonistic immorality in a new and appealing guise. And he says, look, this openness to sex, like whatever feels good is good, there's been some positive aspects to it, he writes. It's got rid of some of the heavy-handed sanctimoniousness, he says, that used to characterize our talk or our refusal to talk about sex. I remember when I was younger, my mother used to have these conversations with me, and I was like, and I realized, because my mother grew up in a very strict German-Jewish home, like they never talked about this kind of stuff, and she felt like that was unhealthy, and I was, you know, and she like went the other way, and I was like, okay, I don't need to have this conversation with my mother. It's just weird. But, you know, so there's been some like positive aspects of this, you know, openness. But he says it's basically a renaissance of paganism in his mind. And it represents a very serious threat to morality, and most specifically to the family. And that's one concept of sexual behavior. And what's the opposite? What's the mamish, like, the opposite view of that?
Asceticism.
Asceticism. That sex is bad. And that's, and he, and Rabbi Lam traces this historically. He believes that asceticism was a reaction to the excesses of paganism's unbridled laxity when it came to sex. And it all started with early Christianity, which taught that sex was the original sin. And now we know the original sin was Adam ate from what he wasn't supposed to, but the way that he would transmit that original sin from one generation to the next is through sex. And that's why the founders of Christianity recommended celibacy and really continue. Not all branches of Christianity, mostly Catholicism. They view marriage really as a concession to man's weakness. Right? A priest will, of course, conduct a ceremony, but what's the ideal in Catholicism? It's the priest. It's to remain celibate. They said it's better to marry than to burn. That's actually a quote from the New Testament. Better to marry than to burn with passion. And it's not enough to control the sexual urge, but if you can, it's better to repress it altogether. And Christianity continues to struggle with a very, very negative attitude to sex, which Rabbi Lam continues to say was born out of a disgust with the permissiveness and the sex glorification of the ancient pagan world. Now, they have a theology to it. It's not merely reactionary. There is a philosophy behind it. But getting back to us, Rabbi Lam makes the point that despite the fact that if I would ask all of you here, you know, which of these two views do we align ourselves with more, you know, the fact that contemporary man seems to have no allegiance to that perception of sex, like it's dirty or it's bad, you know. But he says that Christianity is a major source of Western civilization. And he therefore believes it still leads its own subterranean life of its own. And it affects us. It impacts the way we look at sex as something kind of... I was really a holy person. I wouldn't have to eat. I wouldn't have to have sex. Like, those are the parts of me that I share with the animal kingdom. This is the opposite view of sex in our society. And if you think about these two views, it's like, it's very either or. It's like all good, as long as you don't hurt anyone, right? As long as your sexual behavior does not harm another person. And I get that's what we have to be concerned about in a society. That's what we're going to legislate. That's what we're going to criminalize. Behavior, any kind of behavior that hurts other people. But Judaism's goal is not simply to have a civilized society. Judaism's goal ultimately is to create holiness. And the question is, what kind of attitude and lifestyle around sex creates holiness? So he writes that Judaism rejects, I'll quote, he says it beautifully, paganism's fulsome espousal of uninhibited sexual expression, and denies with equal vehemence Christianity's begrudging concept of marriage and its condemnation of all sexuality as inherently sinful. Depending on how you deal with it, and so much as context, sex is seen as a very positive thing as far as Judaism is concerned, but it all comes down to how we approach it. Can anyone think of any indications in Jewish practice or Jewish philosophy that indicate that Torah views sex in a positive way?
Yeah.
Okay, so, I mean, I can go up against that. In other words, you both said the same thing, that the first mitzvah in the Torah, Sefer HaChinuch, which was an amazing medieval Jewish source, said that's the first command to any human being was to be fruitful, multiply. But is that really about sex? That's more about procreation. We're here to talk about sexuality, of course.
The term that Adam is used, that we describe Adam as having sex, we say Yada.
Oh, that's interesting.
We actually got to know her, and it was like that. This was their, like, it's like, it sounds like a very positive concept.
Yeah.
Relationship, which was their culmination in having sex.
Right, the biblical term, you ever hear that, like, using the biblical term for sex, is knowledge. V'adam, as Moshe just said, v'adam yadat chava ishto, and Adam knew his wife in the biblical sense. Like, what is that? What really is sexuality supposed to be? Now, there's no question that having children is incredibly important, and you can't have children without having sex. And it was always hard for me as a kid to think, like, if it's such an important mitzvah to have kids, to bring children into the world, it's considered like one of those meta mitzvahs, you know, to try to have a family, to try to have kids. And the only way to have children is to have sex. Like, is it really the... There's got to be like something to that, if that's the way God sort of hardwired us, that we can only bring life into this world if we engage in this activity. Like, you know, so how can we view it as a negative thing if it's the instrument through which life enters the world?
Possibly in the ketubah, you were obligating to satisfy your wife.
Okay, so that, okay, in the ketubah, you, it mentions not the mitzvah to have children. It mentions what's called in Hebrew ona'a, which is the obligation to satisfy one's partner. Now, it doesn't refer... It can't be talking about satisfy her in terms of money, because there's another word for that. That's in there too, and it does.
So,
and talks about clothing. Talks about money. By the way, that's the ketubah. By the way, the ketubah doesn't marry the couple. The couple gets married by the man giving the woman something of value. We use a ring, and she has to receive it. She has to accept. That's what that marries them. But the sages ordained that they can't stay married unless he gives his wife a ketubah. In the ketubah, it's basically a prenup. And if they get divorced, or if he pre-deceases her, he has to pay a certain amount of money. It's actually not a very romantic document at all. Everybody frames it and pays a lot of money to the scribe and puts it up on the wall, which is probably a good idea, because I didn't do that. because I know it's written in it, and I'm like, I'm not going to cave in, I'm not going to spend money, and then I lost it. And then you can't stay married, you can't stay living with each other without it, so we had to get another one. We got another one. So, but I'm off the topic now. But that demonstrates a certain value that Judaism places on the sexual intimacy between husband and wife. Now, that's also seen in a verse connected to what Moshe brought up. The verse in Genesis, you can check this out, chapter 1, verse 26. First chapter in Genesis, verse 26. Be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue her. That's what it says. That, says Rabbi Lamb, refers to our instinctual urge of sex and power. But when you go on, a couple of verses later, what does it say? And the Lord God said, it is not good that man should be alone. Remember this verse, very famous. All right. Lo yat adam levado. It's not good for man to be alone. I will make a helpmate for him, which is a bad translation, whatever. Therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother, cleave to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. Nothing about kids. The Torah there explicitly says that a man has to leave his parents, and I don't think that's meant just literally, but figuratively, and that could be an issue for some people, and become one physically with his wife. And here, says Rabbi Lamb, the loving companionship of a husband and wife is seen as an end in and of itself, and that's considered a major component to our existence. He quotes the famous Rabbi Mecklenburg, who was called the Ketav HaKabbalah, who says, I quote, man's inner capacity for goodness can never be realized unless he has a mate upon whom to shower his selfless affection. So that's an indication explicitly in the Torah, in the Bible. Now, other indications that sex is not just a value for having kids. We talked about the ketubah, you mentioned before. And we also know that sex between husband and wife, when it cannot lead to childbearing, for example, while a woman is pregnant, or let's say after a woman goes into menopause and she's unable to have children, sex is still encouraged in Jewish tradition. We simply do not see sex as a concession to some human weakness or like dirty. It can be a very beautiful and holy act, but it depends, of course, on how it's handled. Because we know anything in life, even the most beautiful thing in the world, can be debased and sold to the highest bidder. Or it could be sanctified. And I want to use the word sanctified because that's the Hebrew is kadosh. Because the great Maimonides, great Jewish philosopher, 1100s, he went through the entire Talmud, codified all of Jewish law into 14 books. He gave it one big name called the Mishneh Torah, or the Yad Chazakah. And he was very deliberate about the titles and what he put under each title. One of the 14 books Maimonides wrote was called the Book of Holiness. And guess which two commandments he put into the Book of Holiness. Not commandments you and I would necessarily associate with holy activities. The laws of keeping kosher, Hilchot Macholot Asurot, the forbidden food things and all the kashrut laws, and Shechita also is in there, ritual slaughter. I'm putting that in the same category. And, right, Hilchot Isurei Bia, the laws regulating the sexual intimacy between husband and wife. Now why would a rabbi as great as Maimonides put sex and food in a book he calls holiness? You figure holiness, what should be in there? The laws of Yom Kippur, that's a holy day. Maybe the tefillin for a man, maybe the candle lighting for a woman. You know, things that we really associate with being holy. What does having sex have to do with holiness? And it all depends on what you consider the definition of being holy. Most of us, I would say, and before I read this, this is what I thought. You go to synagogue to be holy. Come to shul, put something nice on, put the kippah on, act like a holy person, you're in a holy place. But where's the real holiness in Judaism? And those of you who have been here before, you've heard me say this in other contexts. Where's the real holiness found in Judaism?
The home, the office, the
What happens in those places?
Connection.
Connection between what and what?
Physical and spiritual.
God.
I would argue, also what Barry was just mentioning, that the potential for holiness can be greater when you're trying to imbue holiness or attach it to a physical activity. What are the two most base physical activities we as human beings engage in? That we are the most aligned with the animal kingdom. It's food and sex. I mean, I think that's why when I used to be, I love zoos, and I used to wait online for hours years ago for like the Congo visit at the Bronx Zoo. Has anyone seen?
Mm-hmm.
You just go in there and like just stare at a bunch of apes, orangutans, and chimpanzees. And it's like amazing because there's like, it's very sweet. They're with their families and they're hanging out. But I think there's a certain kind of identification that we may have. And to the degree that we are able to take the same activities that we share with our primate, maybe according to some ancestors, to the degree that we can engage in those activities differently, elevating them, and not just eat because I'm hungry, and not just because of sex because I'm in heat. that's what the animals do. I mean, that's how they mate. It's not really based on love. It's not based on choice necessarily in the same sense. But we could go the other route, and without being too graphic, some segments of our society are doing just that. And we look at it as just another biological thing. Hungry, eat. And heat, mate. And that's the way our counterparts, I guess, in the animal kingdom engage in these activities. But if we are somehow able to introduce into these otherwise physical activities spiritual dimensions, then the Kabbalists teach that we are able to lift those activities and our souls in the process, and use those physical activities not simply to satisfy our physical urges, but to get closer to God. We think that when you make a blessing before you eat food, or you eat food that's been prepared in a kosher way, that somehow the spiritual energy in the food, in our own bodies, is elevated. Because, you had a whole day's work, so just stay with me for a minute, I'm going to get a little Kabbalah on you. But like, just think about this for a minute. All there was God before there was anything physical in the world. So everything in the physical world, including the chairs you're sitting on, everything originated with God. Everything has a spiritual source. Even the most physical, we have different levels of physical parts of the universe. And even if you go to like mineral, which is the lowest, that also comes from God. And the Kabbalists teach that if you're able to use the physical activity, whatever it is, or the physical object, we are able to bring that physical object back to its original spiritual source, elevating the spiritual energy found behind the object and yourself and your soul and everything around it or connected to it. And we do this, that's why every one of the 613 mitzvot has some physical aspect to it, right? Pick a mitzvah. Throw out a mitzvah. Hey, Allison. Any mitzvah at all. Okay, you're taking the lulav and etrog and you're shaking it around and you're holding up the whatever it is and you are... So we believe that that's just a citrum. It's just like a fruit. It looks like a lemon that you took from a tree. But when you use it according to the way God commanded you to use it and you say a blessing over it, you have the opportunity to actually revert that fruit back to its original spiritual source, and it's because you're basically fulfilling the very purpose of the existence of that item. I talked a little about this when I talked about my tefillin and the leather straps and the animal behind it. Just to remember that weird story that I shared. Now that's with activities that are not inherently physical. Sex and eating are inherently physical activities. There's so much more potential and power to elevate those activities and use them to be connected to both God and other people in a very holy and special way. Or we can just satisfy the urge and move on. And, I mean, unfortunately, that's, you know, resembling the way the animal kingdom approaches this. And it's important to remember, by the way, that Judaism is not an ascetic religion. Right? Judaism doesn't believe in denying ourselves from experiencing the pleasures of the world. In fact, the Talmud tells us that God calls us to task for not enjoying the permitted pleasures of the world. One of the questions that were asked after 120 is, did you enjoy my world? So Judaism doesn't deny. It does restrict. Right? It does say, you can eat this, but don't eat that. You can sleep with this person, but not with that person. It restricts us in a certain ways to ensure that we will not only derive physical pleasure from God's world, but also spiritual connection. And you can't do that if you don't restrict the activity somewhat. Because any activity that is unlimited and boundless and unrestricted will control you at some point. You have to control the activity. If you control the activity, you can then use that activity for a higher purpose than simply satisfying a physical pleasure. And I'm not saying that the satisfaction of a physical pleasure in and of itself is criminal or sinful, but it's a waste. Because God didn't have to create us this way. He created us with the need to eat, to have food, to have sex. Why? Why did he do that? We believe, Judaism teaches, that God did that as a way of being connected to God and to each other on a higher, more profound level. But not if we treat it like anything else. And there's a fascinating story that I want to share with you that you all have in your handout of a young man who was extremely careful in the observance of a certain commandment called tzitziot. And let's read the story together, if you want to join with me. It's page one. It's just page one and two. Just take a look where it says one on top. It's the last paragraph on the left-hand column. Tzeu l'mad mi mitzvah tzitzit. Go out and learn this lesson from the mitzvah of tzitzit. So if those of you are unfamiliar, tzitzit are the fringes that we place on the corners of our garments, supposed to remind us of the mitzvot. Maset. Ba'adam shaya zahir b'mitzvah tzitzit. There was a story of a certain young man who was very careful with this mitzvah, but he wasn't very careful about other things. Shama shiyesh zona b'karkei hayam. He heard that there was a prostitute across the ocean. Yeah, in a certain area. And who was quite expensive. Shenotelet arba'a me'od zehuvim b'schara. She charged a lot of money, 400 gold dinars, a lot of money. And he really wanted to be with her. This is, by the way, one of those passages from the Talmud that they skipped over when we were in high school. The rabbis just didn't want to... Rabbis didn't want to deal with a bunch of... adolescents. Shigala arba'a me'od zehuvim b'kavel hazman. He sends her the advance payment, schedules a time to visit with her. When the time comes, Bavi Yashav ala petach. He arrives at her home, sits at the doorway. Nichnas shifchatav amrala. She's got a maidservant. She's been very successful. And the maidservant sees him and tells her, that man that sent you the money in advance is here. He's waiting for you. Amrahi. The woman says to her, Yikanes, go tell him to come in. Nichnas, the man comes in. Hitzielo sheva mitot. She had prepared 7 beds for him. I'm not going to get into all the symbolism. There's a lot of interesting commentary. 6 of silver, 1 of gold. Between each of the beds, there was a silver ladder. And the uppermost ladder was of gold. She basically climbs these ladders, sits on top, And she disrobes, and he begins to do the same thing. Ba'u arba tzitziotav v'tafchu lo al panav. This is going to sound a little funny, but this is what happened as he was getting undressed. the tzitzit, the fringes on his garment, it says pelted him in the face. Now, I don't know if they smacked him in the face. As he was taking off the tzitzit, they probably got in the way, you know. You wear them underneath your shirt. Nishmat v'yashav lo gal bir karka. All of a sudden, when that happened, he like sort of came to his senses. It was like a slap of reality, spiritual reality. And he gets off the bed. He climbs down all the ladders, and he's just sitting on the ground. Va'afi nishmata v'yashval gal bir karka. And she follows him. And she says the following. She says, by the master of Rome, I swear that I will not leave you until you tell me what flaw you saw in me. And she figured that for some reason he wasn't attracted to her. What did you see that you didn't like? And he answers, by the master of Rome, Shani Menich Chach, and he says back, Ha'avodah, Shelo Ra'iti Isha Yafa Kamotech, I've never seen a woman as beautiful as you. But there's this one commandment that our God has commanded us. And he starts giving her a whole lecture about the mitzvah of tzitzis. He starts telling her what it says in the Torah. It says twice, Ani Hashem Elokechem, I'm the Lord your God. Wants to tell us that God rewards and wants to tell us that God punishes. Let's turn the page. And at this moment, he continues to tell her, these four tzitzit appear to me like four witnesses. And they reminded me of like my mission and my purpose, and I just got shocked, and that's why I didn't continue. She was very impressed. Amra lo, she said to him, "Eini minichecha ad shotomar li, I'm not going to let you go until you tell me your name. Tell me the name of your city where you come from, and what is the name of your teacher, your rabbi." And what is the name of your academy where you study Torah? Now, this is the part of the story that sounds a little fictional to me, because if I was in that situation, the last thing I'd give this lady is the name of my teacher, is the name of my Rebbe, and where I learned Yeshiva. Here, tell everybody. Anyway, he wrote it all down for her. Katav v'natam biyada. He writes this information. He puts it in her hand. Amda v'chilkal kol nechaseha. She's blown away. She's never been refused before. She's like absolutely beautiful, and something's going on here. She's having a little spiritual epiphany. And she gets up and divides all of her possessions into three parts. Shlish l'malchut, she gives one to the government officials, I guess those are her taxes. Shlish l'aniyim, she gives one to the poor. And then one she takes in her hand. She divides all of the property except for the linen. Chutz me'otan matzaot. Matzaot are bed linens, which she had brought with her. The bed linens that she was so accustomed to spread out to be with the men that she was with. And she leaves her hometown, and she travels this great distance beyond the ocean, and she comes to the Beis Medrash of Reb Chiya. She comes to the study hall. Remember, Reb Chiya was a great and well-known Talmudic sage. Can you imagine this? This woman comes to the Beis Medrash. Amar lo Rebbe, and she says, Rabbi, tziva alai v'yasuni giyoret, help me, I want to convert. I want to become Jewish. Amar la biti, the rabbi, a little cynical, says, my daughter, shema einayach natata be'echad min ha'talmidim, maybe your eyes saw one of my students, is there somebody here you're interested in? You know, come on, what's going on here? So then she opened up her hand, she took the written note with all the information from this young man, and she gave it to the rabbi, and told the rabbi the entire incident, and persuaded him that she was converting for the sake of heaven. Amar la, after she converted, she said, the rabbi said to her, Lechi, go, zechi b'mikachech, go, and collect what you have acquired. It was another way of saying, go ahead, go and marry the student that you met at your home. And listen to the way the story ends. Otan motzaot shi yitzi lo be'iser, yitzi lo be'heter. the story concludes with this moral that the same bed linen that she once spread out for this young man to serve his lust, she now spread out for him, it says, beheter, permissibly. But some translate it as in Kedusha, in sanctity. And think about this for a minute. What emerges from this story? The same activity between the same two people could be seen in Jewish tradition as either sinful or sanctified. It all depends on the context, whether the sexuality was merely used to satisfy the desire of a young man, or was it being used to elevate a relationship of commitment and of love. And it's all symbolized in the bed linen. Right? The bed linen, that the same object that was used to satisfy someone's lust can now be used in consecrated union. They had obviously married, and within the context of marriage where there's a true commitment, sexuality is considered kadosh, holy. When you go to a wedding, what is the ceremony called of a Jewish wedding? It's called kiddushin, which means holy. It's the same word as kiddush that we do on Friday night. We're sanctifying time on Shabbos, and under a chuppah, we're sanctifying a relationship. And what's that?
Right after the chuppah, isn't there usually like a yichud room?
Yes. That is just to indicate that the couple is married, because they're not supposed to be alone, secluded in a room until that point. But also, just to finish up, the symbolism of a prostitute is also very powerful. Because what's the biblical term for a prostitute? Not the Talmudic, but the biblical term for a prostitute in Hebrew is kedesha. Kedesha is also related to the word kadosh, which means holy. Because you see that sex has within it the potential and the power of holiness. It just depends on how it's used. It can be a truly kadosh experience if it represents love and commitment. It can also be prostituted. It could be sold. You could use it to sell a car. As I began our discussion with just a little while ago, and just to use it to get people to buy things or to satisfy our base and physical desires. It all depends on what we do with it. And really, in a day and age when, unfortunately, sex is used so much in advertising to sell, to make money, for so many reasons other than to express love and commitment, the Torah challenges us to use it for the greatest possible purpose, which is really, if you think about it, to give. Sex is about giving. And when we give to another person, we not only learn to love them, because the Hebrew word for love is ahava, and the root of the word ahava, which means love, is hav, which means to give. Love comes from giving. You can even take it to the next level, that the more you give and the more you use the physical world to give to other people, and not simply to satisfy our own needs and wants and desires. Not that they're wrong, not that they're bad, not that we have to feel guilty that we have them. It's the way Hashem created us. But the question is, how do we address them? The challenge, and it's a great challenge, this is not simple. The challenge is to approach this very important and sensitive, intimate part of our lives with the ability to sanctify and to elevate and to use sex for what we believe its ultimate purpose was. Because again, God didn't have to make us this way. Hashem could have created, and there are animals that are able to reproduce without having sex. Okay, asexual reproduction, remember that from 9th grade, you know, biology. Hashem could have given us the ability not to need food. We could have been completely self-sustaining. Why does Hashem give us these needs? And give us ways of satisfying the needs and a way of elevating those physical aspects of our lives to use them not only to get what we need, but ultimately develop what we truly want, which is commitment, love, and connection. And sex is a very, very powerful tool for connection. It's the ultimate way, as Moshe, you said before, that we can really know another person, after we have made that commitment. You see, Judaism does it a little differently. We first make the commitment, and then we engage in sexual activity. And it's a little backwards in our society, even though Judaism maybe looks a little primitive and backwards, because the goal is to be able to not use sex as a gauge for the determining whether a person is good enough for us or not. But once we've made that determination, to use sex to build the relationship. Now, that doesn't mean we shouldn't be attracted to the person. I always make that distinction between attraction and sex. Right? Judaism very much wants us to be attracted to the person. And if you're not, you could have serious problems in a relationship. But it doesn't believe that a person needs to be sexual with another person in order to know whether that individual is right or not right for them. Because if you have enough of an attraction and a desire to build something beautiful and to give, we believe that the rest can kind of work itself out. And that's why the sex is referred to as knowledge, because ultimately sex is simply another way of revealing who we truly are to the other person. And you want to do that within the context of a relationship where there's a true commitment. Because who's going to really reveal who they truly are to someone who might be out the door the next day? We only feel comfortable doing that to someone who we feel safe with, we've made a commitment to. And I always like to say that if you didn't need any lawyers or rabbis, members of clergy, to create a bond, then you're not nearly as committed to the other person as you otherwise could. And that commitment is really important for feeling safe enough to reveal ourselves. V'adam yadat chava ishto, and Adam knew, in the biblical sense, his wife Eve. But that came after the commitment. I'm rambling on here. There's some questions in hand that I just... Yeah, Barry, go for it.
I have one question more. Can you speak a bit, if you're willing to, about like the relationship between the concept of sex before marriage, or why not?
No, so I mean, I think I just did. But we could talk about it more. That's okay. I mean, the goal is to use sex to build a relationship, not to determine whether to enter into one. And I think that's the key distinction. And there are a lot of... I remember when I was engaged, my wife's friends took her out for dinner, and they were a little concerned for her, because we usually you move in with somebody before you pop the question. Now, in traditional Jewish societies, we don't. But they were concerned, they were nervous, that how are you going to really know that this person is sexually compatible with you if you don't? Now, the truth is, the statistics show just the opposite, that there's actually higher incidence of divorce of couples who actually lived with each other before marriage. I'm not saying it's a cause for divorce. It's not. But the proposition that it'll increase the likelihood of a successful marriage is not true. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm asking, I guess, does Judaism view having sex with someone before marriage, like a priest, or where is that?
I hate speaking in negative terms. The goal in Judaism is to be engaged in a sexual relationship with one's spouse, husband or wife. That's really what it sees as the mitzvah.
I thought so.
But I realize how maybe ridiculous that sounds in a day and age. You know, a lot of people think, well, maybe that would apply, you know, in Talmudic times when people got married much younger. Now we're getting married older. How can we expect people to remain... I don't want to use the word celibate, because celibate implies some sort of like eternal state of being, which is not healthy and against the Torah. I've always said this in these types of classes, that Judaism is not an all or nothing proposition. If this sounds like crazy, then I don't think it's crazy. I think it actually makes a lot of sense, but it can sound crazy in the world in which we live. But I think we can take some of this. Even if we don't take the whole thing, we can take some of this ideology and philosophy and apply it to our lives and become a little more particular about who we engage in a sexual relationship with and ask ourselves, how are we using sex? And are we gaining from that kind of perspective on sexuality? Because I don't think it's served us very well. I think relationships are a mess in America today. And I think it has a lot to do with the sexual revolution, with... And I said before, there are some good things about it, that we're more open, we don't have the same problems talking about issues, there's nothing wrong to speak about and to be open about. But by and large, it's been a real challenge to morality and to the family unit. The family's gotten really beaten up in the last probably 30, 40 years since the 60s, and since this is a sex, drugs, and rock and roll course. And I'm, as you know, I'm a big lover of classic rock, but I think this is one of the negative things that has come along with the whole drug and rock and roll culture. Just have sex with anyone and just use it as a, you know, we're playing with tremendous potential for spirituality and holiness, and we are just sort of releasing that energy into the world in a very irresponsible way, and we're not getting as much out of it also. The goal really is to actually savor these sexual intimate moments and to really make them beautiful, and believe it or not, that actually enhances the sexual physical pleasure as well. If it's treated as another just biological activity, it ceases to have the power that it otherwise can. You know. Please. I appreciate you talking, because otherwise no one else might be saying anything, and it would just be very embarrassing for me. So,
okay,
thanks for speaking up.
Yeah, I'm not a better talk. Thank you. That's good. So the topic of what you were saying about Maimonides' Book of Holiness.
Yes.
One of the 14 books, I was thinking when you said that about food and sex, like they both relate to like the body, taking food in your body and you have sex with your body.
Right.
And I guess like, no, Judaism views the body is holy and coming from Hashem, and I guess like I thought about like how like using your body in that way in a holy way is kind of like.
Yeah, I mean the body really is considered holy because it serves as a vessel for the soul. But the body also has the potential to be spiritualized, according to the Kabbalists. It's just sort of waiting, like everything else physical, to be redeemed. The great, late and great Rabbi Abraham Isaac Cook, the first chief rabbi of Israel, was a great mystic in his thinking. He used that word redemption often. We kind of think about it like the Jewish people will redeem the world. Redemption is often used just like I'm going to redeem, you know, sort of the sparks of holiness that can be found in any kind of physical. That's really Judaism's uniqueness. Because Judaism is designed to enable us to spiritualize physicality, because we're here, we're physical beings, and we're supposed to embrace that, but do something special with it, you know?
It's okay.
No. Please, no.
No, just like briefly, like yeah. When you say the sparks of holiness, that has to do with the idea that there were like lights that were broken at the beginning of creation or something, and they were scattered.
Yeah.
Throughout. Okay, that's what I
thought. So what you are referring to is famous teaching from the Arizal, 16th century Kabbalist, who talked in Hebrew about the Shvirat HaKelim, that when God created the world, He created this space for physicality, and created physicality, and He allowed some of His holiness to be captured within these vessels. But the vessels were the holiness was too much for the vessels to contain, and they burst. It's called in Hebrew, in the Kabbalistic terminology, the Shvirat HaKelim. And these sparks of spirituality, of holiness, sort of filled the world. And they're there. And they're found within the physical world, in very physical places. And our job, if you choose to accept your mission, is to release and redeem these sparks of holiness, bringing the physical world back to its original spiritual source. Not negating the physical world, but imbuing the physical world with spirituality. And that, I think, is a very subtle distinction between, let's say, Jewish mysticism and, let's say, Buddhism or the more Near Eastern religions. Because the point of the Near Eastern religions is really transcendentalism. It's to escape the physical world and transcend our physical finite limitations and get that sort of nirvana spiritual aha by getting out of physicality. Torah is designed to give us that within the physical world. That's why we have sex. We eat food. But in order to do that, it has to be regulated in a certain kind of way. And the mitzvot are really like a science. This is the way Rabbi David Aaron likes to describe it. They're like a science to figure out how to release the sparks from the physical activities of our everyday life. That's what the mitzvot are about. That's what the whole Torah in Judaism is about. It's about engaging the physical world, not transcending it, not escaping it, living in it, but in such a way as to be able to bring out the spirituality that is latent within. If anybody wants to do more reading on this kind of stuff, so Arya Kaplan wrote a great book called Infinite Space, and also David Aaron, who's a friend and one of my teachers, who I did a podcast with, has a great book called Endless Light, where he really does an excellent job of explaining this. So Arya Kaplan and David Aaron are both great rabbis. If you want to read more about this kind of fun stuff, Moshe, you want to share some? No, if you had a question or comment, please.
No, I mean, I was just having a discussion today with someone who was dating his girlfriend, and they're having a discussion whether they should move in or not. She was of the opinion, he was of the opinion that, like, you know, I don't want to continue, you know, at some point, we're going to get engaged or something, you know, before I move on, we're going to have to move in. And she was of the opinion that, like, you know, I don't know if I do this, you know, I don't know if I want to do that, right? And he was like, come with me, ask me, you know, what's a Jewish opinion on this? And he wanted to understand it. Why? And I think that was when you touched upon it. I just want to bring it up further. I feel like it's a question, like, you know, people regularly have. And it's a fact that, like, yes, you try to figure things more out, and you can always try to understand more about another person. But you're really always are learning them. You're always knowing, getting to know them more. And when you do that in a way which you can be completely vulnerable, in a committed marriage, where tons of relationships happen in an uncommitted way, but there is certain something that when the person could leave the next morning, or when they could leave even the next week or next month, that you don't have that same knowing, you don't have that same knowledge of feelings that will come in a committed relationship.
Yeah,
it's really, I think, something we always should remember.
Yeah, so now I've never been there. So yet. I was having, thank you for sharing that, I was having that same conversation with someone else, and they said, listen, it's not like Judaism prohibits divorce. Like, you could also leave your marriage.
Yeah.
Right? But what's the difference? So, I mean, a person could say, just playing devil's advocate, I'm making a commitment to move in. I'm taking all my stuff from this place. I'm breaking my lease, and I'm moving
signing
in with you.
Your lease.
And I'm signing a new lease that's going to cost me a few bucks, you know, or probably save a few dollars. Cause, you know, what's the difference, really? I mean, there's a very practical difference. I said it before, like, you know, the person could still just walk out.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, no, I think that's another thing.
Now, I'm not saying it's simple. I'm not saying it's not real. People live with each other for years.
Or they could still move into their parents' room.
And a person who's married can say, we're getting divorced. They can. But getting divorced, even today, even though it's the stigma has been lifted, you know, let's say compared to 50 years ago, it still requires lawyers. It still requires, you know, what's that?
It's not fun.
Well, it's not fun breaking up with anyone, but there's a, you know, there are people who kind of, what's that?
Complexity.
There's a little more of a complexity, and I think this is a very practical way of dealing. I just think we need that, especially guys. And I'm going to be a little, I don't know if the word is, but I just think that monogamy, I agree with my friend Shmuley Boteach, who likes to say that monogamy comes more natural for women in general than it does for men. I'm not saying there aren't certain women. There are probably many women who would like to be with a lot of different men, and probably some guys out there who love being monogamous and have no desire or interest of being all over the place with a lot of different women. But generally speaking, this kind of institution where you commit yourself to something and you can't get out of it so easily is a really necessary, I don't want to call it an evil, because I don't want to call marriage evil, God forbid. But it's a necessary mechanism, I think, for men to have. Because I don't think enough men would stay in it. Because it takes commitment. The greatest of lovers, and people who truly respect and honor each other will have real issues and problems. When my wife and I got married, we said for the first like year, we're not going to use the D word. Now we knew it was there, divorce. Like when we got into a fight, we got into plenty of fights. But we said we're not going to go there because we don't want to throw the towel in so quickly. And sometimes when you say a word, it creates its own reality. But we knew it was there. Allison, what were we going to say?
This is a comment about, this is not religious, related, but yeah. Psychological. So statistically speaking, men are actually happier in marriages than women are. Mm-hmm. Like, women's happiness declines when they're in a marriage. They've done studies on
seriously?
This. Seriously? So it's interesting, what is a comment on that? Because women tend to want to get married potentially more so than men do, like what
right.
You're saying.
I have so many more women, and this is purely anecdotal, but my whole life, MJ has 344 matches. So I'm a little of a, you know, should I say that again for the video?
Yeah, again.
MJ has 344 matches, so I'm a little, I wouldn't say an authority on couples getting together, but I'm always getting more women calling me up and saying, who do you know for me, than I am guys. That's not to say, you know, that's not a study. There's nothing scientific about that. However, it just seems from my experience and speaking to colleagues of mine that I have to do more arm twisting with guys than I do with women.
Well, what I'm sort of like reaching for is I wonder, like you're saying, if men feel more inclined to perhaps have more variety
yeah.
than women do. I'm just saying, mm-hmm. that's what you're saying. Then
that just seems to be my perception.
So within the context of spirituality and religion, if having control over one's, you know, function is a way to grow closer to God or something like that, I wonder maybe if that has anything to do with when you're being committed to a woman, as opposed to a woman who's already like, well, I want to be with a man. You know, there's no control over it because it's like a natural inclination for a woman to commit physically. So I'm just sort of, I don't know, we're just thinking.
So you're saying that because... But so for whom is it more natural? Let's take a poll.
Because it's more natural for the woman, it's like, this is no big... Tell me if you're...
Exactly.
This is no big deal. Like, right. It's not really changing my life and that, like, a man is...
It's not as difficult for her.
It's also right. The pressure.
It's like growing through it. Like.
So that's also... What's your first name again?
Julia.
So Julia's making an excellent point. How much is our society's pressure...
You know, you go to a family dinner and they ask all the women, you know, who are you seeing, who are you
dating? Right,
you
guys don't get that as much.
What's your job? What's your
job? Correct.
And it's like, well, I have a job. I right. have a career. Yeah.
Well, really, I mean, if it makes you feel any better, plenty of guys get hocked at these Jewish affairs. Like, are you seeing anybody? Are you settling down already? You know. But there is more of a pressure. I wonder, Allison, how much of that pressure. There you go.
Get married,
right.
Where the guy's like, okay, it takes another 10 years. Like,
right.
Years.
I'm not going anywhere. So that is these are really important factors. I'm really sorry, guys. I got a new phone, and I don't know how to turn it off. It's just out of hand. I wonder, you know, that's a really interesting conversation. I have met men who really want to settle down. I've met guys who... really don't like playing the dating game, or they just really want to find that one special person and have a family. But I found more women over the years that seem to be more naturally, what are you saying about this, please? More naturally predisposed to, thank you, Elia, to wanting to have a family. And it's actually a problem in the Jewish community because there are more women interested than there are men. And it creates a little unbalance. So we have to... What we really need to do... Well, there are more... I think there are more women in general than men. I don't know how many more. What the percentage...
Well, at least like in the Jewish community, it's significantly...
Right.
In Israel. And I think, though... I don't address Allison's question that I think she's bringing up about, like, not question, but, like, okay, it's like men... I mean, as I was getting to before, like, a guy... I was addressing to a guy about whether he wants to move it or not, whether he wants to get into that committed relationship. And I think for guys, because it's so hard for them to open up a woman, and when they have a committed relationship where they can really be themselves and be very open to it, girls could talk to their friends in ways that guys would never talk to anyone
else. To their friends.
They get so much more out of marriage
than I think That's very interesting.
I mean, that's my personal opinion.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I can prove that a little, Moshe, because whenever we break up, like on retreats, we didn't do it this time, and we say, hey, we're going to have a powwow with the guys and a powwow with the women. The powwow with the women, you always want to be with the women. I hate being with the guys. No offense to the guys. A bunch of and sit around looking at each other. Like, you got a text? You got something for us to study? Like, we're not going to just talk. You know? Now, it depends on the guys. If you pull out a couple of beers and maybe a cigar, things will open up a little. But you're right. And I think in that sense, it's very interesting. A guy can get more out of being married. But that doesn't mean... So I tell the story. I wrote this in my first book. I was have a friend right before he walked down the aisle at his own wedding. The rabbi approached him, and the rabbi was none other than Rabbi Soloveitchik. The officiating rabbi went over to him and said, "So, Nu, are you sure?"
No.
Which is not a good question to ask a groom right before he's gonna walk down the aisle. And my friend, like, froze. He froze. First of all, he was very intimidated by this great rabbinic scholar, Rabbi Soloveitchik. And second, like, he didn't know what to answer. So Rabbi Soloveitchik said back to him, "Good, only a fool could be sure." And we know that Rabbi Soloveitchik was extremely, thank you, devoted, absolutely loved his wife. After she passed away, he went to see her grave a lot of times. And even though mourning for a spouse ends after 30 days, he kept it going for about 5 years. And he was incredibly devoted and had an extraordinary relationship with her. And yet, when he was marrying this student of his, he said, "It's impossible to be sure." Now, does that mean the guy just like close your eyes and just like pick anybody and just like it's all up for grab? No. Roll the dice? No, we don't do that. But the idea of absolute certainty, you know, we put a little too much. We don't have, this is my opinion, we don't have enough faith in marriage. So you know what happens in the very Hasidic communities where they don't date a lot? How is it that they can have good marriages? Now you'll say, oh, they don't really have good marriages. Not true. Yeah. A lot of them have wonderful marriages. Some are not, just like in any community. But how is it that they can make a commitment so quickly after 3 or 4 dates? Because they're putting more investment in the institution of marriage. They just need basic compatibility, basic physical attraction, and they're going to like just put the rest of their lives making it work. And that is a really important attitude to go into marriage. Now, I'm not saying we can go to that extreme. I my wife and I dated for 8-9 months. I couldn't just do that after a couple of dates. That's just not the way I was raised. So you got to know who you are, but I was raised to believe in the institution of marriage. And unfortunately, because we're a 2 or 3 generations of 50% divorce, so many of us are coming from broken marriages, and every comedian, you know, is just making fun of marriage. It's like the butt of every joke. It's like an old institution that never really worked. It's not true. Now, Bill Burr likes to say, and I like listening to Bill Burr, except when he curses all the time, but he's really funny. And he's like, you know what? Why would you do this? Now, why would you do this? Somebody said to you, 50% of all the people who jump off of this parachute make it, and the other 50% don't. Would you go? Would you ever do that? Would you take those odds? No. And yet people continue to get married. That's the most unbelievable thing in the world, because I think deep down, people actually want a family, and they want marriage, and they're maybe aware of the statistics, but they're hopeful. Shana.
Also, I just want to say to that is the parachute is that marriage is in no way a parachute, because the whole beauty of marriage is the choice to love somebody. Where you think, yeah, you need a date and date and date until you know for sure, until you realize that there is no way to know for sure about the choice. I think that's where the beauty lies in a relationship.
The choice.
Choosing to marry somebody. Yeah. Choosing to love them every single day. And I think that's part of why there's like holiness in it, where like you're accepting the whole person, no matter where you guys get in life. Like,
right. You need a lot of faith. You do need a lot of faith, though.
lot of faith, but I think it's a lot of choice.
No, it's not blind. It's not blind faith. It's not. But you need to believe in the institution that if I work hard at this, it'll work. Mm-hmm. Now,
there are red flags,
there are red flags, of course, and the Torah does permit divorce, so it's not like you can't ever get out of it if it really wasn't meant to be. Yeah?
Well, to your point of like guys not committing, like, and women, look at like celebrities nowadays. Look at like Mr. Clooney. Like, he just got married. He's like 60. He just had
right.
a kid.
You know, right.
Like, look at all these actors and actresses. They never got married. Like, you know? So it's like, you know, just fool around until you're 60 and then get married.
Right.
Whatever, just a comment.
No, it's a comment. I hear you, and it may look to us like, oh, he's getting the best of both worlds. He got all these like fun years of not having to be committed to one person, and then still got the doesn't have to die alone, you know, to be dour with you. But you have to, I see this in the park all the time. I was like older compared to my friends when I got married. I was 28. But you can go to Central Park and you can see people who in the Orthodox Jewish community would be like Bubbies and Zadies. You know, they'd be like grandparents, you know, pushing their little kids around and their parents there. Meaning everything is just later and later. Two things you have to recognize that. That's less time that you have to spend with your kids. And it just is, and your kids have less time with you. No one's thinking about that, obviously. And I applaud George Clooney. I like him very much. I applaud him for getting married, you know, even if it's a later stage, because there are others who just think the whole institution. I love Bill Maher on some level, but I can't stand when he talks about marriage. You know, he thinks kids are evil and marriage is even worse, and he's missing out on some of the greatest joys of life.
And he lives by himself.
He's not going to know, though, because he's just going to look at all the diaper changing and all the bills and all the things that make marriage and children rearing look difficult, hard, and, you know, not worth it. But, you know, it's like the Marines. It's the toughest job you'll ever love. It is. There's nothing greater than it. You know, there's a word in Hebrew that's reserved for the joy that you can only get from children. It's called nachas. Children and maybe teachers to their students. Like if you guys, one of you guys has been studying here and then you say something really brilliant, maybe I had something to do with helping you get to that place. So I'm feeling like a little nachas.
Where's the source of that word?
I don't even know.
Where'd you get that word from? I mean, where'd you get that thought from?
Oh, that thought?
Yeah, I'm saying, is that like something that says that it's specifically children? Where did you get that?
I've never heard it. It's just my brain. I haven't seen it anywhere because I never heard that word used other than in the context of describing the joy you're getting from your kids or you're telling me them or your students. And I think what it is, and this maybe we'll finish with this, that is, it's the greatest joy in the world because it's somebody else, but you had something to do with it. And that's the ultimate legacy that you have when you're a parent, is that you have brought somebody else and they're doing amazing things because of them, but you had something to do with it. That gives you more than joy. That gives you nachas. I don't even know what to call that. It just means joy. But it's like, you know. We should all have a lot of nachas and joy, guys. I hope this was helpful. We are going to have a little social next week. Is that correct?
Yeah. Krav Maga.
Krav Maga.
Really? We're going to go from love to self-defense.
Yeah.
And... What time is that called for?
7:30.
Yeah, please.